U.S. President Joe Biden clamps down the U.S.-Mexico border.
Today, I'm announcing actions to bar migrants who cross our southern border unlawfully from receiving asylum.
The 35th anniversary of Tiananmen Square.
A 20-year-old student who was on Tiananmen Square when the troops arrived before dawn told VOA it took him nearly 2 hours to crawl out of the square to avoid getting shot. He says he passed hundreds of bodies as he went.
The 80th anniversary of D-Day.
The great Tri-Pipius operation was underway. Through the cloud gaps, the airborne spearhead saw something of the Incan Armada. 4,000 ships and thousands of smaller craft were heading south.
Today is Wednesday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. President Joe Biden announced new restrictions to deny the chance to claim asylum to migrants caught illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border.
Today, I'm announcing actions to bar migrants who cross our southern border unlawfully from receiving asylum. Migrants will be restricted from receiving asylum at our southern border unless they seek it after entering through an established lawful process. And those who seek to come to the United States legally, for example, by making an appointment and coming to a port of entry, asylum will still be available to them, still available. But if an individual chooses not to use our legal pathways, if they choose to come without permission and against the law, they'll be restricted from receiving asylum and staying in the United States. This action will help us gain control of our border, restore order into the process.
The U.S. Congress has jurisdiction over the border, and a compromise law with many Republican demands incorporated into it was on the verge of being passed. But at the urging of former President Donald Trump, that legislation was scuttled.
I'm moving past Republican obstruction and using the executive authorities available to me as president to do what I can on my own to address the border. Frankly, I would have preferred to address this issue through a bipartisan legislation because that's the only way to actually get the kind of system we have now that's broken, fixed, to hire more Border Patrol agents, more asylum officers, more judges. But Republicans have left me no choice.
So let's learn more about this. Joining us now to talk about the action is Aaron Corcoran, a professor at the Keough School of Global Affairs, University of Notre Dame. Let's start with what exactly did he sign? What does it mean if you're trying to come across the border?
I mean, what he signed is an executive order, which is something that the president has the authority to do, which is a temporary solution to a problem on the border, which basically for someone coming over the border, it means they may not be able to access the asylum system, which is the process by which you're asking for the U.S. government to recognize you as a refugee at the border. You may not be able to access that system in the way that you could have before this order was signed, depending on how many people have already entered the border on a given day.
It's a really low number, right? Isn't it like 2,500?
It's 2,500. Yeah. It's a very low number.
So if you're the 2,501st person, if they actually could count it, they would say you can't come across. What do you have to do then?
You have to remain in Mexico. So, I mean, for me, what it looks a lot like is the remain in Mexico policy that the Trump administration created during their administration, which basically prohibited asylum seekers in general, with a few exceptions, from allowing them people to access the asylum system and require them to remain in Mexico, which in oftentimes was a dangerous situation and put people, particularly vulnerable populations like women and children, at risk while they remain in Mexico for their asylum cases to be adjudicated in Mexico.
Now, this takes effect almost immediately, midnight Central Time in the United States. So on Wednesday, this will be in force, and you could either be turned back at the border or deported if caught.
Correct.
Let's talk politics a little bit. The Republicans say, why didn't he do this a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? But they did try to work with the Republicans to get a, as you mentioned, just to be clear for everybody, an executive order is temporary.
Correct.
They were trying to actually get a law passed through Correct. Congress, which would have been permanent, and had a deal on the table mm-hmm. that got last minute rejected after the candidate for the Republicans, Donald Trump, you know, let it be known that he didn't want it passed, allegedly. What was the difference between that law, broad strokes, and what the Biden administration did here?
I mean, I think so. I mean, what's interesting is immigration, generally speaking, the ability to grant immigration status, any kind of immigration status, under the Constitution and under Supreme Court interpretations of the Constitution is generally reserved to Congress. It's a legislative act. Congress has delegated to the executive branch some ability, which is often referred to sometimes as prosecutorial discretion, or the ability to use emergency powers in particular circumstances to grant temporary relief. And that's exactly the authority in which the Biden administration is relying on right now. It's the authority that the Trump administration relied on under Title 42 during COVID. It's the same authority that the Obama administration invoked for DACA. However, in all of those situations, again, it's temporary authority that Congress has given the executive branch. Any permanent changes to immigration law has to go through the legislative process. And so that's exactly what the Biden administration was trying to do in the context of negotiating foreign assistance to Israel and Ukraine, was also trying to work on border security, did reach a deal that would have made permanent changes to the U.S. immigration system, including the asylum process. But that became a non-negotiable item. And so I think there's a recognition that there's some challenges at the southern border. There's an increase of people trying to seek protection. And there is a desire to reform the current process as it exists. And whether that solution is legislative or executive, in all instances, it is in some ways political. But I think the Biden administration was trying to go the legislative route. And when that failed, they then chose to go the executive route.
Thank you so much for the time.
Well, thank you, Scott, for giving me this opportunity to talk with you. I really appreciate it.
Professor Aaron Corcoran of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. On the other side of the border, Mexican president-elect Claudia Sheinbaum said she has received calls from all over the world congratulating her, including one from U.S. President Joe Biden.
Conversé con el presidente de Estados Unidos, Joe Biden, con el presidente de Francia, Emmanuel Macron, con el primer ministro de Canadá, Justin Trudeau, con el presidente de España, Pedro Sánchez, así como presidentes de América Latina, Gustavo Petro, presidente de Colombia, Lula da Silva, presidente de Brasil, Nayib Bukele, presidente de El Salvador, Bernardo Arévalo de Guatemala, Rodrigo de Costa Rica, Miguel Díaz-Canel, presidente de Cuba, Xiomara Castro, presidenta de Honduras, Luis Arce de Bolivia, con el primer ministro de Belice, John Briceño, así incluso con el secretario general de la OEA, Luis Almagro.
She inherits a complicated fiscal panorama from her predecessor, marked by a growing fiscal deficit and long-standing weakness in the state-owned oil firm. In India's election, opposition leader Rahul Gandhi says the India Alliance partners will decide their next course of action on Wednesday, as Prime Minister Narendra Modi's alliance was unlikely to win the overwhelming majority, something that Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones says spooked the Indian stock market.
Indian stocks suffered their worst intraday fall since March 2020 on Tuesday. That's as voting trends in the general election suggested Prime Minister Narendra Modi's alliance seemed unlikely to win the overwhelming majority that was predicted by exit polls. As the votes came in, it looked like Modi's own BJP would fail to secure a majority on its own and would need allies in the National Democratic Alliance to form a government. That could lead to uncertainty over economic policies, like the push for investments-led growth. This has been a cornerstone of Modi's rule, with the economy growing over 8% in the financial year ended March 2024. The Nifty 50 closed down 5.9%, and the S&P BSE Sensex fell 5.7%. The indexes slumped to lows of 8.5% earlier in the day, marking their biggest intraday fall since the first lockdown during the global health crisis in 2020. That's after hitting record highs on Monday, when investor sentiment was buoyed over projections of a big win for Modi's BJP and expectations of sustained economic growth. And the rupee ended down 0.5% on the day, marking its worst single-day fall in 16 months. Analysts said Indian markets are likely to now derate due to higher risk perception, with difficult reforms like changes to land and labour policies and privatisation of state-run enterprises likely, quote, off the table.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. We're following these other stories from around the world. The Argentine government initiated an operation to distribute previously withheld food aid, addressing the urgent needs of the underprivileged as the country's poverty rate soared above 50%. Javier Milei's government caused controversy when it was discovered it stored 5 tons of food for emergencies after cutting supplies to soup kitchens when the president took over in December. Poland says neighboring Belarus and its main supporter and ally Russia are behind a recent surge in migrants from Belarus toward the European Union. The accusation comes as the 27-country bloc prepares to hold elections that start on Thursday. Polish leaders say the influx is part of a Moscow-led effort to destabilize the EU and give political ammunition to the far-right anti-immigrant parties that support or are supported by Russia. Tractors rumbled through the streets again days ahead of the four-day European Union election. Populist and hard-right groups have instrumentalized agriculture throughout the 27-nation bloc in the months leading up to the voting. They claim farmers have become victims of an overbearing EU and environmentalists that fail to take their considerations into account. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, hate and extremism continued rising in 2023. Researchers documented record numbers of white nationalists and anti-LGBTQ plus groups trying to undermine the United States in an inclusive democracy. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias breaks down the findings and the implications for the November presidential election.
The LGBTQ plus community was one of the primary targets of hate and extremism in the U.S. in 2023, according to a report released Tuesday by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Researchers say hate-filled rhetoric and anti-government conspiracy theories also negatively affected immigrants, people of color, and minority faith communities. R.G. Cravens is a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
Extremists, those who oppose inclusive democracy, spent the last year legitimizing insurrection, painting hate as virtuous, and transforming conspiracy theories into mainstream narratives. And they're all in preparation, I would say, towards one of the most significant elections in our history.
A total of 835 anti-government groups were active last year, up from 702 the previous year. The report found the number of active hate groups in the U.S. rose to 595 last year, up from 523 in the previous year. Craven says the groups are moving into the political realm with a specific goal.
To limit pluralism, it's to limit participation, it's to limit democracy itself.
U.S. President Joe Biden presents himself as the only viable option in the November presidential election to stop a rise in hate-filled rhetoric.
We're not going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place that doesn't believe in honesty, decency, and treating people with respect. And I'll be damned if I'm going to let Donald Trump turn America into a place filled with anger and resentment and hate.
Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, sparked controversy when, as president, he blamed both sides for violent clashes at a 2017 white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, that broke out between protesters and counter-protesters. During the demonstration, a white supremacist intentionally drove his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing one woman and injuring more than 30 people. Then President Trump addressed the violence, calling it an egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. Trump has sided with groups at the forefront of book bans, such as Moms for Liberty, which the Southern Poverty Law Center listed again in 2023 as an anti-government extremist group opposed to inclusive education.
The radical left is even slandering Moms for Liberty as a so-called hate group. You're a hate group. Can you imagine? Moms for Liberty, hate group.
Moms for Liberty declined VOA's interview request. Experts say candidates must be careful about the rhetoric to quell any potential violence ahead of the November general election. Teal Rothschild is a sociology professor at Roger Williams University.
For Biden to continue to be present and speak about peace, but also the importance of voting generally. In terms of former President Trump, he's in a tricky spot because he certainly does garner more support when he uses some of this extremist language. But as a result, he's also marginalizing populations that might vote.
Rothschild also suggests voters watch out for conspiracy theories on mainstream and social media that may further fuel hate and extremism. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. FBI Director Christopher Wray said the scale of the China threat is massive. While testifying before the Senate Appropriations Committee, he highlighted the severe magnitude of the cybersecurity threat posed by China.
The scale of the China threat is massive. Cyber alone, they outnumber the FBI 50 to 1. So scaling backwards means that many more cyber attacks at a time when they're trying to target our critical infrastructure, among other things. So it makes the environment safer for hackers.
This week marks the 35th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square pro-democracy demonstrations in China, which ended in bloodshed. VOA was a major source of information and news at the time for the Chinese. VOA Mandarin's Chayu has the story, narrated by Elizabeth Lee.
A bloody moment in time caught on tape in Mandarin and in English.
A 20-year-old student who was on Tiananmen Square when the troops arrived before dawn told VOA it took him nearly 2 hours to crawl out of the square to avoid getting shot. He says he passed hundreds of bodies as he went. The student says anyone who stood up or who the soldiers saw moving was shot.
That's the voice of Al Pessin, VOA's then Beijing bureau chief, reporting on the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square massacre. VOA uncovered old tapes of broadcasts in the Harvard Yenching Library in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the massacre. Pessin says at the time, China was a country still in the shadow of the Cultural Revolution, struggling to shed the utopian experiment of Chinese founding leader Mao Zedong. Economic reforms were starting to make strides, and political reforms, baby steps. Protest movements were sprouting up as early as 1986. Students demanded democratic elections and private newspapers. Then the reformist Hu Yaobang died of a heart attack in April 1989. Triggering a wave of mourning that turned into an unprecedented pro-democracy movement across China. Pessin remembers trying to drive during one of the demonstrations leading up to the massacre.
All of a sudden, these organized groups started marching around us from behind the car and coming on both sides of the car and then reforming in front of the car. And they were carrying banners. that identified each group. And these turned out to be not students. These were workers.
Ultimately, the demonstrators were gunned down.
Students saw four female university students plead with soldiers not to kill them. He says one of the women clasped the leg of a soldier who responded by stabbing her with a bayonet. He saw the soldiers execute the remaining three with shots from their guns.
Chinese authorities have tried to erase this history. Mentioning the incident is taboo in China. Behind the information iron curtain, many Chinese today do not know what happened. For Xiao Yu, Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
And finally,
a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is but the opening phase of the campaign in Western Europe.
That's Dwight D. Eisenhower making the announcement on the radio that the invasion of Europe had begun. D-Day, June 6th, 1944. It'll be 80 years this Thursday, and veterans are gathering for the anniversary.
If you can imagine, from as far as you can see there to as far as you can see there, every maybe quarter of a mile, there was a landing craft or landing troops, tanks, vehicles, anything.
In total, 156,115 Allied troops either landed by sea onto beaches codenamed Utah and Omaha and Juneau and Sword, or were airdropped behind German coastal defenses. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At last count, the number of people displaced by war, violence, and persecution reached 114 million, according to UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. That number is expected to rise in this month's tally. One of the major causes of the growing disaster is the fact that nearly all parties to conflicts have stopped respecting the basic rules of war. Increasingly, civilians are targeted, while rape and sexual violence are used as weapons of war. And since the brutal conduct is meant to terrify, civilians have no choice but to flee, he said. But even as more people need help, less is available, and humanitarians are near their breaking point. The United States continues to take significant action worldwide to support refugees in the countries who host them, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs.
The United States is the largest single humanitarian donor in the world. In our fiscal year 2023 alone, we provided nearly $15 billion in global humanitarian assistance on behalf of the American people.
In 2023, we welcomed 60,014 resettled refugees to the United States, and we are on track to reach or surpass 100,000 arrivals this year. We are doing our part, and we call on other member states to do more, said Ambassador Wood.
We are proud that our refugee admissions program brings refugees from every continent and corner of the world, 79 nationalities from 95 host countries this fiscal year. We believe all refugees from all backgrounds and with all skill sets are deserving of durable solutions, including third country resettlement. This administration is especially proud of its work to help resettle LGBTQI plus refugees fleeing persecution from around the world.
Protection of refugees is crucial. However, more than ever before, we need humanitarian financing, development efforts, and private sector investments to work in concert to effectively address today's complex forced displacement crises, said Ambassador Wood.
We need greater emphasis on local and regional solutions, including lawful pathways for refugees and migrants to move safely and in dignity. The Safe Mobility Offices in Central and South America highlight our efforts in this area.
We remain steadfast in our commitment to protection as the bedrock of humanitarian response, self-reliance, and durable solutions, rooted in the self-identified needs of affected persons, said Ambassador Wood. Today, refugees, asylum seekers, and stateless persons around the world need our commitment to protect them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.